For too many of us, it's become safer to retreat into our own bubbles, whether in our neighborhoods or on college campuses or places of worship, or especially our social media feeds. Surrounded by people who look like us and share the same political outlook and never challenge our assumptions. And increasingly, we become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there. In the course of a healthy debate, we prioritize different goals and the different means of reaching them. But without some common baseline of facts, without a willingness to admit new information and concede that your opponent might be making a fair point, if you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
It'd be too easy to talk about nothing, to talk about nothing. Be too easy to talk like I'm something. I'm balling, I'm stunting. Be too easy, chasing the fame. Playing the game, it'll be too easy. But tell them we don't feel that. No, no, tell them we don't feel that.
Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. I'm your host, Calvin Moore. And as always, I am here with my co-host, Kent Strath. What's up, Kent?
I'm very sad.
Why? Okay, why?
Well, I'm very sad because today was going to be an I had it planned. It was going to be an extra special episode of What's in My Box.
Okay. For the people who are on our show who have never been here, it's a thing where he sometimes orders so much from Amazon, he doesn't realize that he ordered when it arrives, and then he'll open it live on air. So this is not happening today.
Well, it's not happening today because I was watching the mail truck come down the street knowing that something is arriving today, being excited about getting it, and then watching the mail truck come down the street and looking at my – well, not my watch, but my phone and going, I can't wait anymore. In order to get to the show on time, I have to go. And the mailman – is, I don't know, a block away. Couldn't do it.
Well, as it turns out, you probably could have stayed.
Turns out, since we're starting 15 minutes
that's
late.
Okay. This happens all the time. But we are a little
what it was, by the way, was Apple AirPods.
Oh,
the wireless
okay.
Earbuds.
You gotta let me know how those
are coming today.
You gotta let me know how those are. But we are a little behind the eight ball, and this is gonna be more of a truncated episode because everybody's kinda on a clock. A shorter clock than we normally have.
You can
have for
say
our show
the
today.
Reason why we have to get out of here early.
You're not the only one who has to leave
don't
early.
Don't afraid.
Today.
Be afraid to
People
tell
need
them.
To leave early
Kent's got to pick up the kids and go see Newsies.
That's why you're leaving.
That's
early?
Happening at
okay.
7.
All right.
Yes.
Anyway, so real quick, we're going to read our bios. This week we are talking about gentrification. So the name of this episode is "Coffee with Room for Gentrification," and we have three people who are going to be. Our panelists today, and real quick, we're going to read those bios. First up, we have April Boyle. April was a founding team member of DHive, where she was director of small business initiatives and helped launch the Build Institute, which is where we met, an idea activator and small business accelerator focused on access and equity. As a network of grassroots programs, Build assists people in turning their project or business ideas into a reality by providing the necessary tools, education, and a support network to get started and thrive. April believes local independently owned small businesses are the backbone of a city. They create jobs, keep wealth and ownership in the community, redevelop commercial corridors and neighborhoods, and preserve their culture. Additionally, April sits on the board of Kiva Detroit and the advisory board for Pony Ride. She's also co-owner investor in Gold Cash Gold, which I just had a great meal there for the first time a few weeks ago. Gold Cash Gold building and restaurant in Corktown. April is married to Model D co-founder Brian Boyle and is the mother of three amazing boys, Carter, Graham, Henry, and Rowan. April, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Mr. Damian Ellis. Damian Ellis is a Detroit-born and raised entrepreneur, finance professional, and community activist. With over 10 years of experience under his belt, he has become an expert in the financial services industry, playing critical roles in the execution of over $12 billion in financial transactions that include collateralized loans, municipal bonds, and foreign exchange options. We're not worthy! In 2016, he organized a group of community members to found The Social Scene, a shuttle service that shuttles young professionals to black-owned businesses for happy hour with the purpose of cultivating economic activity in urban areas across the country. Damian's strong commitment to the city of Detroit and economic development have led to major developments in underdeveloped communities. I could have worded that better. That was me. Damian has previously worked on Wall Street for both JPMorgan Chase and Goldman Sachs. His passion for eliminating the wealth, unemployment, and property ownership gap within the black community brought him back to his hometown, where he successfully completed the Detroit Public Schools $500 million construction program with the Wallbridge joint venture.
You shortened this bio.
I did.
This is shorter.
Yes. Okay. There's a lot of stuff that he does, but today he serves as the president of the social scene. And last but not least, welcoming back to the show, I think this is your first time back since our first episode, Miss Nikki Pardo. Nikki Pardo has worked in leadership roles in corporate, nonprofit, and government sectors. She is an energetic and enthusiastic diversity trainer, facilitator, and consultant. Provides innovative perspective on implicit bias, discrimination, and civil rights compliance. She has been featured in several publications, made guest appearances on multiple talk shows and podcasts, including this one. Serves as a keynote and panel expert on the panel on the topic of diversity and inclusion throughout the country, and is a consultant on numerous diversity-related projects in the city of Detroit. Nikki has served on numerous boards and currently serves as Birmingham's Race Relations and Diversity Task Force Board and the Hispanic Police Officer Association Board Michigan Chapter. She is a graduate of the New Detroit, the Coalition's Multicultural Leadership Program, Prosperous Detroit, and facilitator for Build Institute, a small business incubator in the city of Detroit, which we've already talked about. She holds an MBA in leadership and a Master of Science in International Administration. She is also a state-certified mediator, nationally certified global career development facilitator, a member of National Career Development Association, the National Diversity Council, Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, get it, girl, Jack and Jill of America, and In Forum. Nikki, thank you so much for coming back on the line.
Someday, Calvin, you're going to go on vacation, and I'm going to say, you know what? While you're gone, I'm doing a show. And here's how the bios are going to go. This is Nikki. She kind of knows what she's talking about. Damian has done $12 billion in deals. I'm Ken. Let's have a show.
Well, here's the reason why
I could have gone to the bathroom during those bios.
Here's the reason why I read the bios fully for this particular episode, because I have so many discussions with people who will complain about something or deny that something exists and that it's not a problem, and they'll speak as if they're experts. I had a large conversation about gentrification today, and I said, here are the problems. Here's historically how we got here. And he's like, well, what's the solution? I said, later on today, I'm going to be sitting with some people who have boots on the ground, who are literally kind of experts in this area. So let me listen to them rather than provide some sort of solution I don't know. And so that's why I wanted to read those, to show that they are qualified to talk about this particular topic. Normally, I don't read those all the way
through. Indeed, they are.
So when you hear the term gentrification, what thoughts come immediately to mind? What's the definition of that word, or how have you seen it worked out in the real world, in and around you?
Well, this is April, and it seems to me, especially working on the ground in Detroit in the neighborhoods, gentrification does have a negative connotation. And it is a very hot, controversial word. And I think the challenge comes when we aren't sharing a definition, right?
Yes.
I did some research on the definition of gentrification today, and there are all kinds of definitions out there. And especially working in economic and community development in the grassroots neighborhood level, we are trying to raise the quality of life for the community members. Right. So how do you do that in a way that doesn't displace people, that doesn't change the culture and flavor of the neighborhood, and that makes sure that everybody has a seat at the table?
Okay.
And that's the kind of – that's what we're doing.
Okay.
At Build. And I'm sure that the word gentrification has been used in the same sentence as Build Institute before, which is bothersome to me.
Given the people that are coming through your program, I could understand why it's bothersome, right?
Yeah, mostly women, yep. Mostly people of color, and mostly people from the neighborhoods. And then also, I'm sure that the word gentrification and the concept has been used in the same sentence as Gold Cash Gold.
Yeah.
Corktown.
Corktown, yeah, for sure.
And Corktown is one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the city of Detroit. Just because there are white people there doesn't mean that it's not diverse. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
People see white people and they say, oh, that's the hipster neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily true. Corktown is a very diverse neighborhood. There are African Americans and Hispanics and many types of people there.
Okay.
So that's just my 30-second take.
All right.
When I hear the term gentrification, I just think that it's two tiers to it. I think the first tier, it's an economic, and Damian especially would be the expert on this, but there are two tiers. So it's not black, it's not white, it's not Latino, it's not Asian, it's green. It is about money. And secondary, my point is race is secondary. So I think that's where it kind of gets kind of muddy, where, you know, people are talking about, oh, our neighborhoods are being gentrified. Gentrification is an economic thing. So it's just the fact that, we see with the city of Detroit, it's whites that are moving in and gentrifying neighborhoods. But it goes, to me, it goes back to green.
Okay.
Yeah, I would agree with the economic component. And I bring up oftentimes when I talk about this, Boston. And that's one of the very few places in the country where white people, for the most part, are being gentrified. It's the impoverished white population of Boston, for the most part. And of course,
Denver too.
Yeah. So of course, it's African Americans also in Boston, but from a percentage perspective, it's mostly poor white Bostonians being displaced. But at the end of the day, for me, gentrification is a price point issue where your cost of living is too high for the existing people to survive in that area, and they're pushed to areas where they can survive. Okay. And it's just like a replacement of population. And oftentimes in America, it's a color thing where the people leaving look a certain way and the people coming in are another way. But to Nikki's point, it's economic.
Okay. It's interesting on the economic side of things, racial being secondary. As someone who is a historian, right now I'm reading a brand new book that just came out. Brand new book, old information. Just needed a new voice saying it. Last name is Rothstein, but the book is called The Color of Law, and it talks about the untold or the hidden history, which isn't really hidden if you just look for it, of the U.S. government segregating the United States. You know, through all sorts of different policies, especially redlining, when you think about that here in the city of Detroit. And so when I hear that race is secondary, I think it might be secondary now to a degree, but how we got to where we are, race was primary. And so people being displaced are being displaced from places where they were put because of what they look like, what their race and their heritage and their background was. So I don't know if economics is necessarily primary. I don't know if either one are primary, or they're both primary, if anything, at least in my understanding of how we got here, how it continues to work, who's moving out, who's moving in. It's interesting about the Boston thing, but for the most part, when people think gentrification, especially in Detroit, it's, you know, poor black people getting moved out, right?
And that is exactly what I was thinking when Nikki was talking. Yes, it is about economics, but the history of people of color in this country is that they've been cut out of economic systems and haven't been invited to the table, haven't been allowed to participate, to accumulate wealth, to own housing, all of that. So I agree that has to be right-sided so that things can be equal.
Right.
So for me, when I talk about it being economic, when people push race to the forefront, and I think you've done a little research on my work, it's very racial. So it's not like I'm race averse.
Right.
At all.
Absolutely.
But I push economics to the forefront because I don't want the solutions to be hand-holding. I don't want the solutions to be, you know, it's unfair that black people are being pushed out, so let's carve out a space for these black people. No, let's make sure black people are participating economically. So if the solution is rooted in economics, that way you have a real solution where the gentrification isn't white and black, it's economic. And the black people are just as likely to participate on certain economic levels as others.
Okay.
I don't like the whole, you know, quota of this demographic or that demographic. If we're all equal, we should all be equally able to compete in the same economy. And to your point, historically, we all haven't.
Okay.
And then I think that's what the race issue, you know, that's the result.
Okay. Let's go.
So gentrification is largely generally thought of as a negative terminology, but isn't investment in previously disinvested areas a good thing? This question brought to you by Dan Gilbert.
and a good deal of my friends. I mean, hey, you know, isn't it? Nobody did anything with this area for years. Billionaires sat on these buildings and hoped to God someone would call them, and nobody did. And then a Dan Gilbert moves in, renovates, gets on the phone, calls people who moved out of the city, state, and country, gets them back to Detroit, and now we're at 99% capacity, both residential and commercial space.
Sure.
Isn't that a good thing? That's what I hear.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, isn't that better than having empty buildings is what, you know, a good deal of people are asking.
Yes, it is. It's a beautiful thing. But to me, the integration is not clicking in some areas. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to speak for the entire, 138 miles or whatever it is.
139 square miles,
Close
enough.
Yeah, you know, right?
142 if you include water.
Right,
but go on.
Right. So, you know, it's just the whole integration. And someone made a really good – someone said a theory the other day where people are coming from the suburbs to the city. Well, I was raised in the suburbs, and we do everything. We build back in the back of the house. Like, you know, we put money toward decks and patios and all that. In the urban areas, when I lived on Clark twice and in downtown and on the east side, we did everything in the front of the house. So, you know, I knew my neighbors. I would come home. I would change. Well, I lived in front of Clark Park at one time. We would walk around the park together. You know, it's like everything was in front versus back. So that's urban versus suburban. So I think maybe that's what it is. I don't know. But the whole integration process. So I have loyal Detroiter friends, and they're saying that the new residents are just not very welcoming. They're not – well, not welcoming because they're the –
they're the new ones.
They're the newbies. But, you know, they're just not receptive to community. Again, I'm not making a blanket statement. This is just feedback that I've gotten from my friends. And
and if you're coming from a fences make good neighbors background.
Right.
To a place with no fences,
but you
have a fence mentality.
So then my question is to the actual loyal Detroiters versus the new Detroiters, are you being welcoming in your area? So my thing is just the whole integration process, because it's happening. There's nothing, I mean, it's going down. As we sit here, it's happening. So that's my thing. Like, what is your process, you know, of entry, you know, to integrate yourself into this new neighborhood that's already been established? And that's the beauty of Detroit, where we've had several homes.
A new neighborhood for them.
Right. And so, like, for example, we have generational homes where it's like you have, it's easy now we're down to maybe like the fourth generation in the home. So it's like we are already established. So you are new to our neighborhood. So it's kind of both ways. It's with regard to integration. Like, how are you? Are you welcoming to the new residents? And you are a new resident. Are you going out of your way to, you know, integrate yourself into the communities?
So for me, the concept of investment and whether investment is good or bad, if, you know, the alternative is no investment at all. What? Is it good for whom is my question. If you're coming in with a bunch of money and these buildings are abandoned, now Dan Gilbert and company come in and invest all of this money in these areas that me as a native Detroiter, I cannot rent office space in these buildings. I cannot park in or around these buildings. I can't do anything in where you're investing. So when the question is that a good thing? Is it a good thing for whom? I don't give a damn if there's a big, new, shiny building downtown that I cannot afford to even get a parking spot at. So it's like at the end of the day, should things have been invested in? Absolutely. But if I'm going to be pushed out of any opportunity to participate in this new investment, then no, it's no benefit to me. And that's what's I'm witnessing happening. When I was with Detroit Public Schools, there were a lot of community members who would we were the program managers. So we were overseeing the contractors. And a lot of the community members would give us a lot of heat because they never saw black people working on any of these buildings. Mm-hmm. So they would go around to all of our project sites and counting black people. And then the response is always – you know, from, because I worked for a team that, you know, was it was half black owned and half not black owned. But the response is like, how do you know? You can't tell how these people, based on what they look, where they live. But statistically speaking, if Detroit is 82% black, it's pretty impossible for all the, you know, all white people to be working. And you're really talking about you employ Detroiters. So years later, when Dan Gilbert comes and it's, you know, his development all downtown, I myself went around all of his sites, and he hires one contractor, Ram Construction. They're a Livonia based company. I counted. I got up to 100 people. I counted. There were 6 black people working on all of these sites. So it's like all of this development, we can, you know, round of applause it. But at the end of the day, if you have 6 black people out of 100 that I counted working, how many Detroiters are you employing? And how excited should I be about your investment when a lot of that money isn't going through the hands of the citizens that have been here?
Exactly. And working when I was part of DHive and at the beginning of the Dan Gilbert development phase and seeing empty buildings and having conversations with some of the newcomers coming into town. And I'm a lifelong Detroiter. I was born in Detroit. I grew up in Southwest Detroit. And so
that's where Build is located too.
Now Build is located there. Yeah. Yes. It's very important for us to be in a neighborhood. But if you come to Detroit and you don't have and you're not working through a lens of equity and inclusion and understanding the history of the city that you're working in and 50 years of disinvestment, the riots, all of these things, and that is not at the forefront of your mind as you are doing these developments and how you're going to participate in lifting up Detroiters, that is a problem.
Okay. Now, okay, so here's a question in regards, and this is kind of on topic, off topic. When I think about this particular conversation, it is around new development. It is not around old development. For instance, in about 4 weeks, I have to go out to California for a weekend. I want to go to L.A. I know, right? I'm going to suffer. I'm going to go out to L.A., and I want to go to Rodeo Drive. Rodeo Drive is not for me. I probably can't afford to park there, but it's old, so I don't have a problem with it. I just want to see Rodeo Drive, right? It was developed the way that it was for a specific reason. I imagine years ago it displaced somebody or some people felt some kind of way about not being able to afford to buy stuff on Rodeo Drive. There's a big famous scene in Pretty Woman with it, like big mistake, huge, right? So I look at things like the development in downtown where nothing was going on in certain respects. Like I do tours for a living. You got my business card right there. So I will walk people through an area called Capitol Park. Capitol Park is the story of gentrification in the downtown core specifically, displacing people out of, you know, the old Griswold. They're now building Griswold 2.0 on top of a parking garage. But people got moved out of there, and people got moved out of what is now the Malcolmson building. And then the other buildings, the 11 other buildings, well, it's 11 buildings total. So 2 buildings people got moved out of. 11 other buildings have been abandoned for years. But when I hear people talk about gentrification in that area, they talk as if all 11 buildings displace thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And I'm going, I feel like this conversation is starting off dishonest because you know that nobody was in that building and nothing was going on. And so the question of for whom is legitimate, but if no one has been in an area for years and someone comes in and says, we are building this for X group of people, yes, the rest of the city is 82% black, that's fine. Does a company that invests their own money have a responsibility to make sure that black people get to live there, or do they get to build what they want for themselves?
So for me, like I said from the start, I always try to make it economic.
Okay.
So it's like
that makes sense.
To reserve rooms for black people, that's not my thing. I don't fight against people who do that, who lead that charge, but you're never going to see me create an initiative to say we need this amount of space for black people or low income people.
Well, they do it with the 80-20 split.
Right,
that's the language for it.
Right. And it's to me to appease people and to account for a certain amount of diversity and quality of life for certain groups of people who don't have access to it. But for me, if you spend $100 million to renovate a building, regardless of who you allow to stay in that building, I think you have a responsibility to the economy that you're building in to make sure as many people within that economy get those jobs. Like if I'm going to build here and I'm going to say I love Detroit and I'm going to try to help revitalize Detroit, which is the speech that not only Dan Gilbert gives, but a lot of people give. How can you really be invested in revitalizing Detroit if, you know, and I'm just throwing numbers out here, but if, yeah, if 90% of every dollar I spend goes to citizens' salaries who don't live in Detroit, who don't pay property taxes in Detroit, mm-hmm, who don't pay income taxes,
okay,
in Detroit. So for me, it's more of a
they would pay income taxes in Detroit. Well, if you work in Detroit, you got to pay that tax. Right.
You would pay half of it. Right. So it's 2.4% versus 1.4%. Okay. But to your point, they would pay something. But I mean, it's about return on investment. Why would I not get the most, you know, out of that opportunity? And for me, it's just like there are able, willing bodies here ready to work. So I just don't think there's the effort to make sure as many Detroiters as possible have access to this opportunity. Now, your point is it's a private company. He can do whatever he wants. A lot of my criticism is directed towards public dollars. So Dan Gilbert is an example because it's a popular example, but I can't hold his feet to the fire. It's his own money. You know, okay. I'm really upset about a lot of the private people who take public money. He hasn't yet taken a lot. I think it's on his horizon, but I'll wait until it gets there.
So let's double down on that, because that is the next question. What responsibility do businesses and government? So you differentiated between the two.
I wanted to say something also. First of all, my response was really to another question. I don't know if my mind is playing tricks on me about the integration. But going back to the investment and the contract. So I recently have had two conversations, and one was about one of my friend's husband works on the site downtown on a site, and he said it is so horrific, and he's black, and the things that are being
said.
He's one of six.
One of six.
Really, he's biracial. So what is that? 5.5?
I don't know.
So. So he said, like, there'll be, like, a noose in the bathroom and on the porta potties. Mm-hmm. They're writing just the most offensive. And I'm a previous civil rights investigator, so I'm thinking, you know, I've heard it all. But the things that are being written on these porta potties are just so obscene that it got me. I was emotional. I was mortified. So then they are like, okay, maybe we'll go with another porta potty company. So then they went with some other, that porta potty company, because of the quotes, severed the contract and said, we're not, you know, you guys are really kind of defacing our property. So they went with another one, and so the same thing happened. So I was speaking with another friend of mine, and so back to that, there was no resolution.
Okay.
And he was so upset that the contractors, so you have brothers going to these contractors saying, listen, do something about it. This is harassment. And there was nothing done about it. So another conversation that I had was, and I don't know how true this is, how legit it is, but there is a percentage of people of color they are to hire, and they're not. And so they're just paying the fines.
Yes.
That they're willing to do that. So correct. It's like, I want to go with my boys, and we all know what that's cryptic for, and, you know, good old boys, whatever. And, you know, we're going to work with whomever we want to work with, and you're not going to dictate, or these policies or whatever are not going to dictate who I bring on to my job into this contract. I'll just cut a check. When I heard that, it just...
I have a buddy, Tim, who is very high up in a major paving company in the state of Michigan. He was over at my house today looking at a patio I'm putting in. And we were out last week, and he said, you know, to a degree, we can't find certain groups of people that we want to hire. We can't. But if you want federal dollars, you have to hire X amount of people of color. Well, sometimes we can't find that. More often than not, we can't find that. So we build into the price of our bid the fine. They build it into their price.
It's 100% correct.
So it's sometimes it's not that they don't care from his perspective. He's obviously working in that construction industry. He said, it's not that we don't care. It's just that people don't want to do the work. They won't come out and take the jobs. We have all these jobs available. He's like, we have thousands of
people.
The people of color that...
The people of color don't want it, so it's the people of color, right? So,
well, he's saying we can't hire. I mean, it's like you can't go out and force black people to work anymore. If you know, I remember
I keep
that
hearing
ended.
That too. They can't pass the urine test and all of this. And I've heard
no,
that.
No, it had nothing to do with drugs. It was like, we're not even getting people applying.
Oh, that's what they're saying.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. So I didn't know that.
So there's, because like I did work on that.
I didn't know that. So that's good for me to know. So
I did work on that Detroit Public Schools program. Mm-hmm. And this was, this initiative started in 2009.
Okay.
So we were the only show in town. This was before any money was coming to Detroit. So every contractor in Southeast Michigan was at our doorstep trying to get a piece of this $500 million. So that, there are a lot of these issues that are actual. So when it's like, let's come down, let's have a conversation about solutions, there are these obstacles. And the result is we can't find anybody. But it's because there are obstacles preventing certain demographics of people from getting into these positions.
Right.
So, having a car.
Having valid ID. Mm-hmm. And passing a drug test. Right. Those are three of the, those are real issues. Those aren't like.
Well, I don't want you operating heavy machinery if you're under.
Well, I understand.
I'm not, any kind of influence.
I'm not saying it's invalid. I'm just saying these are the issues. Mm-hmm. This is what people, we should be focused on.
Okay.
Because if that's preventing black people or Hispanic people from getting access to these opportunities, then let's.
Instead of paying the fine, do a car service and get these people to jobs.
But the BS thing with a lot of the contracting that's going on right now is it's BS fines. So on the Detroit Public Schools program, that was a real fine. So think about this is like $430 million hockey rink stadium. Mm-hmm. Their penalty was $500,000. That is not a penalty.
Right. So that's how they can build it into the.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
So on, for example, on a $50 million school that we managed, their penalty would have been 3% of their contract. And that 3% came out of the whole contract. As a general contractor, my margin is only like, 10%, 5%. So most of the money that I get, that $50 million, I'm subletting that out. And I get a management fee of about $5 million.
Okay.
So if I get a 3% penalty,
that's going to hurt you.
That's 3% of $50
million. $1.5
million? And that $1.5 million comes out of my management fee of $5 million. So you just took a huge chunk of all of my money versus this $500,000 that's coming out of a I'm talking about $1.5 million coming out of a $50 million school. A $500,000 penalty that came out of a $430 million school. So what the metrics that they're using, the penalties and the incentives that they're placing in these contracts are straight BS. It's not serious.
So, to strengthen your point, I think you might be light on the $450 million. I heard the whole district was like $680 million.
Yeah, the district is $680
million. Okay.
That they haven't really started on yet.
It's going to be well over $1 billion by the time they're done. Let's move forward, though, because we're in where I want to be. But I want to talk about responsibility here, corporate responsibility, government responsibility, because you did differentiate a little bit earlier. What responsibility do businesses and governments have, if any? Well, we know governments do. If any, in making sure that the revitalization of an urban core, a neighborhood, or a region do not displace or forget those who have been making a living but have not been able to pull themselves out of a particular economic situation. Case in point, Nikki runs a group called The Pack, which I got to attend. April, you were there last week as well. And it was a fantastic event. We were all talking about a sorely misguided ad that Bedrock had placed on a window. For those of you who are listening who are not from the Detroit region, Bedrock is the commercial leasing arm for Quicken Loans, which is a large company that Dan Gilbert owns here in the city of Detroit. But either way, there were no black people of color featured in this ad.
A couple.
They were serving.
Right.
But, how do you see Detroit, or what's the Detroit that you see? Something like that. And this isn't to bash them, but I got up and I had said that, I generally operate within the system. I understand that a system operates a certain way. As you said, a business is there to, they do what they want to do. You can't hold Dan Gilbert's feet to the fire. I had someone who deeply disagreed with me on that. Yousef Shakur, I wanted him to be here tonight, passionately disagreed. But I said, I hold companies to the law. I don't hold companies to a moral code. If you want morality, go to church, go to a mosque, go to a synagogue, go to a philosopher.
Wasn't that's where the law, though, at certain slavery was part of the law.
Well, sure, sure. So, and laws are about power. Laws are definitely about power.
Yeah, so the status quo, I think we need to hold people's feet to the fire.
Correct.
Status quo, the white male, no offense if there are any listening, would hold on to the power if we didn't take it from them.
Correct. And I don't think that you're wrong by any means. What I was saying was I don't look at a company and automatically expect moral behavior from them. Now, if a company does act moral,
we should,
but because I know that that's them. Not what they do,
right.
Or that's not their goal, I don't get upset when they fail that.
If that's the problem with our capitalist system is we, you know, it's profit above everything else, and it's messed up our whole society, in my opinion.
Adam Smith wrote, The Wealth of Nations, which is, you know, the magnum opus for classical economics in the United States, if not the world, and he's the father of modern capitalism as we know it. But he said, look, the brewer, the butcher, and the baker don't bake bread and brew beer and cut the meat for you out of altruism. They do it because of their own self-interest. And so when I'm looking at a company, I'm going, they have self-interest. This is what they do. Now, a government I might have a different expectation of because we are the government. A company, they've got private money. They come in and do what they want. So the question is, when a company says, hey, I want to be in Detroit, like a Dan Gilbert's Quicken Loans, what responsibility, if any, do they have to the community, and what responsibility does the government have to the community?
Well, I would also say our capitalist system was built on the backs of slaves.
Slaves, yes.
So again, I mean, if we're talking about true capitalism, we have to look back through the history and say, how did the Dan Gilberts and the Illiches make and be at the economic status that they're at versus other people who are not at that status?
To be fair,
yes,
to Mike Illich, God rest his soul, Mike Illich opened his pizza restaurant 95 years after the end of slavery. So he didn't build his empire on the backs of slaves.
Oh, really? But his family did and his legacy did. And he benefited from the benefits of
being white, because that's cool. I mean, if we're saying that he had a built-in benefit by the fact that he was a first-generation Greek immigrant. But when he opened a single pizza restaurant without a single slave involved a century after slavery – without a single slave involved a century after slavery was abolished – not going to blame Mike Illich.
But then 70 years later, you have an African-American pizza owner who's putting his pizza shops in a bunch of schools. But it's years behind a Mike Illich because of economic disadvantages that disallowed
people
from – could a black person open up a pizza shop and be where Mike Illich is 70 years ago today? Could they
I'm confused
own a little,
by – we're
could a black
shifting
person,
time.
Could a so black person have done what Mike Illich did back then?
Right.
And be where
slavery,
Mike Illich's family
Jim Crow,
is
250 years of racist policies have held back many people of color, where Mike Illich did not have those barriers. So, and this is not about Mike Illich; it's about it's about privilege, and it's about discounting when we talk about capitalism. How did we get here? And I think we have not paid our dues to make sure that we appreciate how the capitals of this country were built on the backs of free labor. That is not capitalism. We're a capitalist country when things are going well and the corporations keep their money. When things are going bad, as we just saw, we're a socialist country and we're bailing out the banks and the big corporates, but the little guy got nothing. And to me, that's a problem.
Okay. Thoughts? Continue thoughts on this.
Well, I'll take the government, being that I'm a former investigator for the Michigan Department of Civil Rights, and as well as the EEOC, the Government Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So you said that these companies are kind of doing what they want to do, but they can't.
I mean, they have to operate within the law.
You have to right, because there's no company on this planet, or this, let's say this country, I'm not going to, maybe I need to reel it in a little bit, the United States of America, who can circumvent civil rights laws.
Right.
Because they're there for a reason. And that goes right back to what April is saying. They are in place for a reason. And
And April did say that, you know, hey, slavery was legal. That was the law. So not all laws are moral. So when I'm talking about a company operating within the law, that's a moral one. You know, civil rights, you know, not discriminating against people because of their color,
right,
or their sexual orientation,
their
religion, all that stuff.
Hiring, termination,
right,
transfers.
But it's not moral. It's only economic. All the studies have shown that diverse teams, teams with women, teams with people of color, outperform those who don't.
True.
So
yeah,
it's not a moral issue.
There's
it's an economic issue.
To it. There's a definite science to it. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm saying the rightness of the law is
moral.
Right.
I'm disagreeing. That's all.
Yeah, I'm just saying that the law is that particular law, not discriminating against people based on all those different things, that is actually moral. But then there are laws that companies operate with.
I respectfully disagree.
Okay, go on. Why do you disagree that the law is moral?
Okay.
Are you saying the law isn't right?
No, I'm saying the law, right, but you can also dissect the two.
Okay.
Is that what you're doing?
No, what I'm saying is there are laws that a company will follow, and you can look at that law and go, that law is totally immoral. Why are we allowing that? Mm-hmm. Like if a law said company doesn't have to hire black people, that company wouldn't hire black people if it didn't have to. That would be an immoral law, right? But if a law says and agrees with that which is moral, black people are humans, you know, they deserve to have jobs. Hispanic people are humans. They deserve to have jobs. You should not discriminate against gay people. You should not discriminate against trans people. Those kinds of things. Those laws are moral, just saying that the law agrees with that which is morally right. That's all
I'm
saying.
I guess it's more so compliance.
Okay.
And it's more so mandated.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that's where – when I think of – we're saying the same thing.
Yeah, we are. Moral. Yeah, so.
So I my addition would be in terms of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So – a lot of times there are excuses. One brought up earlier about there not being enough people. So on top of the IDs and the drug tests and transportation, you also have an opportunity with getting massive amounts of tax abatement. So even though it may not be a government-funded project in its entirety, a lot of just being in real estate development and finance being my background, a lot of these deals do not work without some form of a tax abatement, whether it be historic, whether it be Brownsville, because you are in an old city and you need hazardous material abatement dollars. All of these things are tax dollars that are used to circumvent financial gaps. So I think there should be some type of mandate where if you want to qualify for these types of dollars, these are the certain things that you have to do. And I just think bankruptcy was in Detroit was 2012. A lot of these projects have started and have, you know, this is years and years and years. If we were to start with an apprentice program that was in place to train Detroit people, mm-hmm. 3-4 years down the line, you know, there could be no excuse. Oh, there aren't enough Detroiters who are actually qualified to do these jobs. You had an incubator training them. So now when more and more money is funneling through your city, you've trained up your core of employees in your city who can attack those jobs. I just think there has to be a pure intent on building up the city, and that just doesn't exist. There's a lot of talk about emotion and what's fair and what's not fair, and I just feel like if we think from an economic perspective, you have a lot of citizens without jobs, you have a lot of citizens without money. If we put these dollars to work in a way that builds up the city to provide opportunities for itself, then you're going to have a thriving economy. And that's just not, like, if the more people are getting left out, the more and more anger.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And we repeat things that have happened in the past.
Yep.
Totally agree.
And I think our last question, Ken's going to ask it here, I think is going to get into the brass tacks of how do we do that? You know, not just flood the system with dollars. How specifically do we flood the system with dollars? So
there are people who view gentrification as good. I think there are a lot more who view it as bad. Regardless, it's a thing that's happening and people have got to be ready for it. With this in mind, what role do current city residents have in economic self-determination?
I think both build and social scene kind of play into both of those
build.
In a way. Yeah. So
Okay, so I'm currently facilitating a class for April, and this class, it's a Motor City Match class. It's all black women except for one white guy, and we just love him to death. He's our honorary soul sister. But, I mean, these women are jamming. They, I mean, they're business ideas because, I mean, don't get me wrong. I've been now with April for almost 2 years, and you kind of hear the same businesses, you know, the usual suspects, we'll call them that. But these women are thinking outside the box. One of them, to the point, stumped Aaron Bonahome, an attorney who's also is a, mm-hmm. a co-facilitator.
Yeah, I love Aaron.
Yep. She stumped both of us. We were on the phone in the middle of the night one night trying to figure out one of the businesses that is just so, it's a healthcare thing. But I'm just saying that, you know, we at Build are doing it. You know, you talk about incubators. Well, this is a small incubator, small business incubator that's generating and kicking out. I will speak as a woman of color, and all that Build is doing for women of color to give us support and to give us the whole family, the ecosystem, that and the resources that you know, to all the way from financial to marketing to legal to accounting. So that's when you talk about self-determination, we have it.
Okay. Yeah, April, I left out part of the bio that you sent to me, just the milestones that, mm-hmm. that Build has gone through. Talk a little bit about those real quick, just kind of also piggyback off of some of what Nikki was saying there, because I think what you're doing is important, and I like the brass tacks of what you do.
Yeah, so since January of 2012, we've graduated over 1,100 folks, mostly women, 70% women, 60% people of color. Mostly low to moderate income from every single zip code in the city of Detroit. And it really is about, like I said, about access and equity. We're trying to change the face of entrepreneurship, meeting people where they're at and making sure that they feel included in the process. We skipped over question number 5, which I think is really important. And it's this whole idea of the psychological feeling of not being included in, mm-hmm. in entrepreneurship and in finance. People don't feel like they're part of that, that they're included. I know as a woman, mm-hmm. it's still hard being at the table as an entrepreneur trying to get funding. So I can't even imagine what it's like being a person of color and a woman of color trying to play this game.
Well, it was interesting the other day at the PAC, there was someone who was, I mean,
yes.
Who was the
House
woman
of Purvin?
House of Purvin. So she got up and she was like, I'm almost in tears. I don't understand. Like, you guys are saying you might attack my business if it came down to it. And, like, there's all this stuff that's available. And essentially that's what she said. There's all these resources available and you're going on as if they're not. And so I felt like she didn't put it that way. She didn't put it that way by any means. But I felt like some of the angst of, hey, I went downtown and I didn't feel welcome. There's that.
Right.
But then going into there's nothing for us, she's like, well, no, there is something for us. So I think there was a mixture of how I feel, which is very true and real, to there not being any resources, which is not very true and real. There are resources available. So I found that there's a mixture of fact and fiction when it comes to how people perceive themselves being welcome in a revitalized area. Now, we're specifically talking about Detroit, but I've got stories from New York. I've got stories from L.A. I've got stories from Austin and areas that have been gentrified and redeveloped over the years that this kind of narrative kind of plays itself out.
Well, to Ken's point, it is about self-determination and having the courage to take the risk, the courage to come to a Build class. That is not always an easy thing to do, and that is incumbent on the individual to make that choice. But it's also really important for us to make sure it's a safe, welcoming environment that people feel.
You also offer one where, I mean, kids become an issue. People are having kids.
Yep.
And you've got babysitting available, I think,
yes,
in some of these classes?
Yes, we do. We run classes with childcare, and that's the whole point. We're trying to
because that would be a barrier for a lot of people. Why they don't take that risk. Look, I got to put food on the table, these
right,
kids.
Right, I got kids. I'm a mother of 3 boys. Believe me, I get it.
Okay.
I get it, and so that's what we're trying to say. And also, you know, we work with a lot of grassroots lifestyle companies. one and two person enterprises. And we are working so hard to try to get respect and resources into these companies because it's still Michigan's economic development is focused on tech and scale and the big projects, you know. And most of the LLCs in the United States are one- and two-person organizations, and those folks need support. And if we can add one job to all of those companies, we would transform this economy. Hmm. And so that's what we're working on.
Okay.
So I want to respond to a few things, but I'll start just by some of the things that me and the groups that I work with are doing. So the social scene. Which is Soul Scene.
Yeah, I love that.
SoulCiaLScene. We create social events and social experiences with the intention of bringing revenues to Black business owners. And it is rooted in the statistics that Black business owners hire Black people at a 64% hiring rate and non-Black business owners hire Black people at a 10% hiring rate. Mm-hmm. So being in a 80% plus African-American city, according to the Urban League, unemployment in the Detroit metro area for Black people is 17% compared to 4.5% the state average. If the unemployment issue is concentrated on Black people, if your city is overwhelmingly Black, then we want to focus on employment opportunities for Black people. And the best way for us to do it is to follow the numbers. If these are the companies that hire African-Americans at the highest rate, then how do we grow those companies? And we do these social events throughout the month, and you know, and we target off days. So most of our events are on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, because these guys don't need us on Friday. They don't need us on Saturday.
Right. Okay.
So we'll bring, like, you know, a vast amount of business to a company on a day where they're getting nobody. And I just we really made an effort to make sure another good business that's doing what they're supposed to do in a prime location doesn't fail. So that's just a way of, you know, we didn't get funding for this. You know, it's just us saying, hey, here's a need. And we got together and did it. You know, I came up with a concept that kind of evolved with the group of people that were with us, and it's working. But also, I think in terms of the responses that you guys were talking about of people feeling like there weren't resources, that there is an issue with people not having their own self-determination and ambition. But I think there's also an issue of people feeling comfortable or actually knowing what's available. Because honestly, if we're going to have a real conversation, there's an issue with the funding, whether it be 501c3 or federal or whatever. Certain people are getting more funding and more attention than others. There are a lot of people who are trying to put initiatives like April's together who may put it together and they don't get any dollars.
Okay.
Detroit News ain't at their door. Free Press ain't doing no story on them. And from the perspective of a young African-American woman or a Hispanic woman who sees every leader of all of these great nonprofit initiatives, all of them are white, and it's all of these white people coming to Detroit with all of these dollars and all of this attention. And the assumption is that organization is not Black. Like to be honest with you, I have never been to Build an Institute, but I heard of it. My assumption was it was going to be a bunch of white people, not because it is, but just because this is how it is in Detroit. You had Challenge Detroit. Challenge Detroit, I think the first couple of classes were like maybe 50, 60% Black. Challenge Detroit, it ain't a bunch of Black people that apply. And we can say they're not applying, but maybe they don't feel comfortable in those environments. Some of these guys come, the Challenge Detroit guys, they come to our social scene events. And they're telling me, man, this is the first event I went to all summer that had a Black vibe. They're sitting there like so excited about, I didn't even know this existed in Detroit, because Challenge Detroit has all of these events. And this is the first one where I actually saw some Black people. And I think there needs to be some effort, not only in how they orchestrate these programs, but also the people who are awarding dollars, whether it be Kresge, whether it be the Kellogg Foundation. It can't be this funnel of white hands that funnels all the money out to everybody. You know, I'm just having a hard time finding these black nonprofits, because they do exist, but I'm having a hard time finding the ones that are getting the media attention and that are getting the funding dollars. And I think that is a comfort issue that maybe black people shouldn't just only look for black leadership. But I mean that's kind of what we do. And if there were more of black leaders getting funding to put these initiatives together, I think black people would start more so coming to those initiatives.
Well, I want to say a couple of things. One, it just escaped me, so I'll go to two.
One will come back.
Well, no, you're talking about, right, and I hear what you're saying, because Hatch Detroit, last round, all four finalists were white. So it's like, you're Hatch Detroit in a city that is predominantly black. How in the world did all of your finalists become white?
Has there been a black winner?
We won.
Detroit Vegan Soul.
No,
Detroit
Vegan Soul won.
Lyft Cycle Detroit.
Both in West Village.
The second thing is,
yeah, Detroit Vegan Soul did not win. They were in the top four.
Okay.
It was another Bill. But regardless,
Sister
Pie won.
Well, bad example. But how did that even happen? So, and the second thing, when we're talking about, you know, looking and seeing the sea of white women, so when they had the rally in D.C. and all these women put on their pink hats and flocked to D.C. and you even had them here in the city, you know, you had them in Ann Arbor, you had them all over the points. So my question to everyone who went, what are you going to do to be a catalyst for change? I'm all for getting picket signs and wearing hats and rocking shirts and all that, you know, and braving the cold elements. But, okay, so when are you going to, as white women, are going to, because you talk about the access, of course, on the, you know, hierarchy, of course, it's the white male and then the white woman. So it's like, what are you going to do to allow us to have seats at tables? You know, I mean, so you're the only one that's going to be able to do it. But I will say, let me not use an absolute, there have been white men who have been extremely helpful in getting me opportunities. So I'm not going to make a blanket statement. And I'm a white woman here. So, but my point is, what are you going to do about it? You know, so it's like when you have all this fire and brimstone and you're marching around, I mean,
well,
I
can answer that as a white woman. Mm-hmm. And again, as a lifelong Detroiter and being born in the city of Detroit, I can show you my birth certificate.
I'm going to need to make sure that you're speaking for all white people right now. Though.
I mean, so.
No pressure.
I know, because
it's about
time
somebody asked a white person for the birth certificate.
And you know what? Exactly. And I know I have a blonde streak in my hair, and I look younger than I am, so people think I'm a hipster, and that build, because build is led by a white woman. What I'm doing, Nikki, is to make sure that my leadership team reflects the demographics.
Okay, I know you're not talking to me. Talk to them.
Right, right.
Because I saw you build your leadership team,
you
and
know,
I've seen it.
So my leadership team reflects the demographics of the people that we serve.
Well, Delphia, when you first started.
My board, my co-chairs reflect the demographics of the people that we serve in this city. And so I am doing the best that I can to be proactive when it comes to that. And so it does make me sad when I hear Damien say that, maybe he thought he never heard of build, or that build, you know, they think it's a. And I'm just trying to do the best I can to
bother her. You struck the chord.
It does. I get it. I'm white. There's no way around that. I might be a little bit more woke than my friend Kent with that slavery. With that slavery statement, but maybe not. I don't know Kent very well, but I'm just saying.
We've been friends for a while. Kent's pretty woke at this point, but.
That statement, though, about Illich, to me, it seems so not
okay,
quite.
So going
there.
Back to, going back to
but
April,
anyway, so.
Who thinks that April is an anomaly in Detroit?
Anomaly in what?
And being a white woman who's opening doors and inviting people of color to tables.
So I want to clarify. I don't think she's an anomaly. But what I do think, though, my frustration isn't with April. I think everybody who gets this funding and this attention should use it the way she's doing. My frustration is with the Kresge Foundation and the Kellogg Foundation.
And I would agree with you.
And these people who are only awarding certain people. It's not what you do with the money. It's the fact. I'll give you an example.
It's who gets the money or what the people.
Yeah, it's like there's only a certain amount of people, even if it's a minority program, it's the white guy ran minority thing for the black young boys. And they're giving all this money to this white guy who's in these schools. And it's like, well, you didn't see the 30 other black guys that were trying to run a similar program. So I'll give you an example. The Detroit Regional Chamber, which has its, diversity and inclusion issues. They are hiring people, and they hire this, young white girl who's a very nice girl. And she is just like April, probably she will be one day. But the
she wishes.
I have no idea who we're talking about.
And I'm glad you know her. But my point is, when we're having these conversations, she's really trying to have a very candid conversation with me. And we're talking about race. And it's just like, what can we do at the regional chamber? And in my mind, I'm like, if there was an opportunity to hire someone in your position, hire a black woman from Detroit and not you. And that's my thing. It's not that I'm mad at this girl at the chamber. It's why is the chamber, if they have the opportunity to employ someone, give them a salary to address multicultural issues, why are you getting the white girl
and
from
you
Atlanta?
Hear that Best Detroit just did the same thing.
Exactly. You keep hearing the same stories over and over, and it's because like hires like.
Homogeneity is a thing.
And since mostly the white people are in charge, they keep hiring the white people. And it is going to take some white people and some white men to start making those decisions. And I have to tell you, I'm new in the nonprofit world. The last 5 years, the whole funding thing, it has been really eye-opening to me, and in a not so good way. And I totally agree with what you're saying. And it's so deep and complicated, and it runs in the same vein that we're talking about with corporates, It's most of these foundations are run by families, and their boards don't give a shit about equity and inclusion.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had conversations with people, and I'm like, don't you guys care about equity? No, it's not on their radar at all.
Why do they have to think about it?
Right.
And that's what my friends
they
always
care about
come
the arts,
to me.
Yeah. Or they care about, and I'm like, oh my God, we're in trouble. Yeah. We're in trouble.
Because of my work
we're keep perpetuating these bad systems that keep us exactly where we're at.
Yeah, people are always asking me, why do they do that? Why, because they can.
And so we demand,
I think to Calvin's point earlier, I agree about the law issue. If people don't have a disincentive, if they're not penalized or if they don't get real incentives to do stuff, you're not going to hold them to anything. And it just is annoying to talk about what people should do. It's just like what you have to do. That's all that matters to me.
Well, I think we're out of time, and I'm going to have all three of you back on different episodes that I think you all would definitely fit on. Fantastic. Thank you all so much for being here.
Don't have April
today.
And me together again.
No, I love having you. I think this is a great panel.
So ends the shortest episode in show history, I believe.
Wow.
No, our first two episodes were only an hour.
Really?
Each. Okay. Yep. So thanks so much for listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. Make sure you check out our website, leadingquestionsnow.com, where you can find all of our episodes from this season and last season, bios, a calendar of upcoming topics, and even suggest topics for us to talk about. If you're interested in bringing our program out to your college, university, or organization, email us at hello@leadingquestionsnow.com and we'll get back to you. To our live listeners, thanks for tuning in. To those of you listening on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or SoundCloud, thanks so much for subscribing. Please leave us a rating and tune in next week where I've invited on a group of diverse women for Women in Transition Part 2, Women in the Workplace. See you next week.